This is CD 18 of an 18 CD set containing sessions from a 4-week course by Ram Dass titled The Yogas of the Bhagavad Gita. This CD contains part 2 of session number 14, The Conclusion.
KK was going to sing a bhajan for us. Get the real thing while we have it here. And then we'll take some questions, and then we will sing a final kirtan together as we go off into the sunset.
Thank you.
Those of you that were at the Shiva chant will recall that around the middle of the night when KK took over, there was a quality about the subtle ways in which he leads kirtan that is unique to an Indian mind. And we'll do a short kirtan now, where a lead in response, where we'll respond. And the way in which it's a sophisticated sadhana is that you really have to surrender into it, to follow it, and to, you can't hear it with your intellect, you've just got to open to it and then respond. So just let it happen that way.
Jaya, 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 Ja Thank you.
Just a word about the chemistry of these moments, that when a space is created through some instrument like KK, or sometimes through me when I'm speaking, through each of us in our own way, it's very much a result of the interaction of the moment, the fact that this situation allows something to happen. And there is sometimes, I've said this before, and I'd like to reiterate it, just this kind of image I have about different qualities of experience. That when something hasn't quite made it, we applaud. when it begins to make it, we are together in silence, and we sometimes just want to keep expressing our thanks, and we come up and people want to hug us or thank, you know, sometimes just look at us or like get an autograph or whatever. But as we evolve, when we share these moments, we realize that every one of us is creating it as much as anybody else. And I think you may have thought when I began by honoring you as students that it was some kind of idle thought, but it some nice social grace. But it isn't that at all. It's that your openness allows this process to happen. And so when you feel thankful, allow it to be turned inward too, as well as outward. And express your appreciation to yourself for allowing these spaces to exist. Because the highest lectures I ever am involved with, at the end everybody just gets up and walks out. Nobody needs to hug me or thank me or anything. Because we all know we're here. You don't have to collect it. I remember one night at the Fillmore Auditorium, the Jefferson Airplane and the Grateful Dead were playing together up on the stage, and Pigpen and Marty was singing Waiting for the Midnight Hour for 2 hours. And about 40-50% of the audience was on acid, and the light shows were particularly beautiful. And the place was very much of an astral situation. And Bill Graham, who ran it, came rushing up to me and he says, "What am I going to do? What am I going to do? We'll never be able to stop this. And we've got to stop at 2 o'clock or the police are going to come." I said, "Don't worry, Bill. Just tell him it's over." Bill walked on the stage and said, "Well, it's 2 o'clock. We have to stop." And everybody just very quietly turned and walked out. Because it was enough. Because it had moved into a place of purity where we were all sharing a space of present momentness where we were experiencing enough. Are there any questions? Yes. The question is, some confusion about mindfulness or consciousness or awareness is a very exquisite technique for being aware of movement and senses, the various sense doors and the way that works. On the more global or social level, we've been talking about this self-remembering or remembering one's whole game, if you will. It's more like a social perception rather than a specific moment-to-moment, mind-moment, or thought or feeling perception. It's a much more global thing. This consciousness of something is all a stage before an ultimate place where you are consciousness, but you are not self-conscious any longer. It's just the whole process is one of consciousness, but out of it just comes the act. If we didn't talk at all about the being of moksha, the liberated being, and that person just is form. I would just like to read you one thing which describes a little bit about that. This is a description that was written about a Roshi. It was written by Trudy Dixon, who has since died, and it was really written about Suzuki Roshi, who those of you that knew realize was somebody we were very graced to have in America before he died of cancer. And this is almost a statement of what consciousness ends up looking like when you're finished being self-conscious. A Roshi is a person who has actualized that perfect freedom, which is the potentiality for all human beings. He exists freely in the fullness of his whole being. The flow of his consciousness is not the fixed repetitive patterns of our usual self-centered consciousness, but rather arises spontaneously and naturally from the actual circumstances of the present.
The result of this in terms of the quality of his life are extraordinary. Buoyancy, vigor, straightforwardness, simplicity, humility, serenity, joyousness, uncanny perspicacity, and unfathomable compassion. His whole being testifies to what it means to live in the reality of the present. Without anything said or done, just the impact of meeting a personality so developed can be enough to change another's whole way of life. But in the end, it is not the extraordinariness of the teacher which perplexes, intrigues, and deepens the student. It is the teacher's utter ordinariness. Because he is just himself, he is a mirror for his students. When we are with him, we feel our own strengths and shortcomings without any sense of praise or criticism from him. In his presence, we see our original face, and the extraordinariness we see is only our own true nature. When we learn to let our own nature free, the boundaries between master and student disappear. In a deep flow of being and joy in the unfolding of Buddha mind. That's the ultimate type of consciousness we merge into. Questions? The question was that often when she listens to Trungpa Rinpoche, it feels off the wall, and it doesn't feel always as if he knows what's going on. And would I comment on that? All questions are fair questions. I find that the optimum strategy is to minimize the degree in which I put myself in a judgmental position regarding another person, like, especially like Trungpa Rinpoche. Sometimes some of the things that he says or does seem irrelevant or trivial to me, or wrong or insensitive or whatever. And I allow that space, I allow it to be. I don't decide about it. I don't have to know where I'm at every minute in relation to another person. And I sit with it, and sometimes much later it all gets clear to me that he was a nut, or that it was an incredible teaching, or whatever, you know. But I've had a deal with my guru who is, who I've like written down hundreds of things that he's said, half of which I still don't know what the hell it was all about. And I just sit with him, and every now and then another one, oh yeah, like 4 years later something he said, because he wasn't living in the time space I was living in, he was saying something relevant to an entirely different time space that only when I evolved into another time space did I understand the meaning of it. So that I feel that especially when you are open to teachings from somebody who is that you intuitively sense is a high teaching, you try to set aside that whole judgmental quality as much as possible. And if you don't understand, just say, well, it is not given to me to understand at this moment, and keep being open. Because the minute you say, no, he's off, so you pull back, you're just protecting yourself, and there's no need to protect yourself. You can stay open, and whatever works will stay with you, and whatever doesn't will flow through you for later. But you'll find that when he says something, or when most conscious beings say things, somebody in the audience is hearing it just what needed to be heard at that moment. But there, you've got to realize that everybody in the audience is at a different plane and, you know. Today, when we were discussing things, sometimes he would say something which later I realized he was saying it for the audience that was going to be hearing it, you know, out in radio land, not to me at that moment. But he was looking at me, and we'd go through these disparate moments, right? So I feel it's best to just sort of stay open. Yes. Something about the selfish and possessive aspects of love. I've gone through this previously, but I think it's so relevant and pertinent, it is in my life anyway, that I'm going to go through it once more. When you feel not connected, and then something turns you on, you get hooked on whatever that something was. It's called your connection. And as you know, a junkie is very hooked on her or his connection. And that hooking is a form of love and hate. It's very intense emotion. And it wants to possess the connection, to reassure itself that always there will be that connection. Now, actually, in the case of love, when you fall in love with another person, that person is your connection to the place in yourself where you are love. So you say, I am in love with her or him. What you mean is, she or he turns me on to the place in myself where I am love. And since you don't know how to turn yourself on to it or to become it yet, you get very possessive and protective and jealous and angry. And in a way, you not only love the person, but you also hate them because of the power they have over you to withdraw that connection to that love. As the awakening deepens, as your purification proceeds, as your mind quiets, as your heart opens, you begin to quietly dissolve into the place in yourself where you are, in fact, love, which is the Atman. And as that starts to happen to you, the neurotic need for your connection starts to dissipate. Because now you don't need to be turned on to the place because you're beginning to be the place. And as you get stronger, you become the light that lights other people's ways. And at this point, you're in a new position because your love is manifesting free, going outward. And everything it falls on, you experience this incredible love for. And since you don't want anything from your beloved anymore, all you want from it is that it manifests love. You can't coerce love in another being. It's catchy. It goes from one being that is love to another being who resonates with it and becomes love. So you get to the point where, like when people come and say, what can I do for you? All I'd say is work on yourself, or just be the light you are, or, you know, you're doing fine. You're doing it all, because what can we do for each other other than to become that love? And as we become it, there's nothing you want from anybody else. Then the whole possessive, jealous, romantic quality of love falls away. The problem is that we're in between stages in our evolution now. We're neither fish nor fowl, and so we're in the position where we are experiencing this Christ love, this compassionate love, this freeing love. But all of our old habits, when we're getting near this intense stuff, is to control, grab, and try to cling because we're afraid tomorrow's going to be hell. Okay? And after a while, you realize that as long as you stay here in the moment, tomorrow is never going to be hell, because every time tomorrow gets to be today, if you're here, it's all enough. No matter how horrible it is, if you're right here, it's enough. It's the only thing that makes it horrible is time, is when you're caught in the future or the past or clinging. But when you're right here, even at the moment of death, it's all okay if you're just right here. If you're not holding to life or grabbing at death, but just being here. And once you get over the fear because you realize that you're not going to lose it because you are it, then all of those habits start to fall away. But for a long time, we're caught in between and we're still reasserting old habits. And we do this bizarre thing where you are opening and so you find yourself incredibly in love with a being. And that being responds and you both experience this incredible love. And then out of old habits, you go into, I want to be with you forever and let's move in, and you do a whole thing. And then you walk down the street to get a bottle of milk and you meet somebody and you're incredibly in love with this being and they're incredibly in love with you. See? Now you're in a perplexity. See? See, because unless you got the bread to set up two apartments and do a whole thing, see? And what happens if it happens on the way to the, you know, I mean, it could get very messy, see? And the thing is that many people, some people are free to be able to be here in love and then go on, and others aren't. And we're at a very delicate stage where we have to listen to each other very carefully. Because it's not easy, it's very easy when you are free and somebody else is suffering to say, well, tough baby, that's the way it is. Okay. But realize there's karma involved in that too. Yeah. The question was, in Be Here Now, I described a time when we went up to the mountain to a cabin, and Maharaji brought me into a room and tapped me on the forehead. And he said to me, he said two things. He said, you like to feed children? I said, yeah. He said, that's good. He said, you make many people laugh in America? I said, yeah. He said, that's good. And then he tapped me on the forehead. And then I left and we got in the car and went home. We did a lot of other things. We had apples and stuff like that, as I recall. No, I don't have any idea about any of that. It's all just stuff. It's all just stuff. Yes. Well, some of you, you will notice you've been starting to have some dreams about Maharaji. And some of you have noticed a sense of presence at moments in these scenes that has felt perhaps different than what you were quite used to. And so, and the question was, where is Maharaji now? I don't think you need to look very far. I found that when Maharaji left his body, nothing much changed at all, because I didn't really have him localized in time and space. And the statement he had made, I am always in communion with you, didn't seem to become nullified just because he had dropped his body. In general, the desire to make contact with people that have left their bodies must be done thoughtfully, because if it's somebody that has more work to do on themselves, your clinging to them may hamper their work. And it's best when somebody dies to help them go on rather than to try to hold it all. If you are to continue work with a being who isn't in a body, that will become manifest to you if you just quiet yourself enough. It's like, remember Sri Yukteswar saying to Yogananda after he had died, Yukteswar had died, and it was Babaji that said, your thought vibrations practically blew me out of the room, so I couldn't come to you. Like the being was waiting to manifest, but Yukteswar, whoever that was too agitated to be open to the possibility of that happening. So a lot of it is quieting your own mind, and then you're in the presence of whatever you need to be in. Okay. Yes? Would I make some comment about suicide? Well, I'll tell you a story, and you can work with the story as you will. There was a boy in New York who came to me for guidance about sadhana. And everything I taught him, he did almost better immediately than I could do it. Right? I had learned a few tricks here and there, and I just started to share with him various things about pranayama and hatha yoga and so on. And within a few weeks, he was just moving so fast with the stuff. And he was living in the village in New York. And then I was in New Hampshire, and he used to come up and visit me in New Hampshire. And then in the fall, I said to him, well, I've taken you about as far as I can go. You need a better teacher than I am. I suggest you go to India. He says, well, I'd like to spend the winter in a cave in Arizona. So he went into a cave in Arizona, and every month or so, he'd fly to wherever I was just to share with what was going on with him. It was in April. I received a letter from his mother, and she said, my son has entered Mahasamadhi. That was her statement. That's far out. I mean, it was a statement that he had left his body. He had died. She was implying that he had become, that he was a fully enlightened being. And I was a little confused by this. And she came to me and she told me that he had been found with blood on the wall from his nose. in this room, and he had left a message. He had left a diary, and the diary said, it was in big scrawly writing, she showed it to me, it said, "I am with Christ, I am going to become one with Christ. Mother, you shouldn't fear, I will always watch over you. Tell Ram Dass I have finished my work, I am leaving now, goodbye." So that was pretty interesting. A few weeks later, his brother came to see me, and he said, "I have to tell you this, that, because I've got to tell somebody now, that actually I went out to visit my brother with another friend, and we all took LSD together. And then we went swimming, and my brother was very far out in the space, and he came over and he just looked at me, and I think, I don't know what he was seeing, but he went to embrace me, and I got frightened. I got into a sexual panic, and I pushed him away. And then he got paranoid, and he told us both to leave, and we left, and that was the last we ever saw him alive. So when I heard that, I then thought, well, sure, what happened was he got paranoid, and he went back to his room, and he was having all these visions, and he decided to die, to go, and he wrote this note, and then he must have forced the pranayama, and he burst his heart. He just forced it with the power that he had because of the LSD. So it's a suicide, really. He killed himself. So he's obviously not finished his work. That's what my head did, okay? Now, I said to the mother, look, I was a little reticent because she was talking about Maha Samadhi. I said, look, I'll tell you what. When I go to India this year, I'll take a picture of your son and I'll take it to my guru and I'll just ask him about it. So I put a picture in my bag and I went to India, and a couple of months later, I was with Maharaji, and I remembered that I had this picture, and I went and I got the picture, and I didn't say anything. I just brought it up to him, and I handed him the picture, which was a high school graduation picture of this boy. Maharaji looked at it, and he said, "He's dead. He left his body." "Yeah." He said, "He died from medicine," meaning the LSD. "Right?" I said, "I thought so." See, it was the place in me that, right, I thought so, of course. And he said, "He finished his work." "What?" And then he proceeded to quote line from line the diary, see? He said, "He came to Christ, he became one with Christ. His mother should not worry, he's always watching over her. And you should realize he's done with his work now." I said, "Yeah, but he died from the medicine, how could he be done?" You know, I was like, because in my mind there were these categories, suicide and couldn't, you know, and so on. And he said, "No," he said, "he's finished his work." And at that moment I began to realize that when a person had finished his work, it didn't really make a lot of difference how they did go out. You know? And that we couldn't really judge about another's death very easily. All we could see in ourselves was that certain acts are done out of ego. And when they are done out of ego, they determine the next sequence of acts, and so that they force a rebirth at a certain level, because the attachment to ending life is still an attachment to life, which forces rebirth into the physical plane. So that in general you would say that suicide is an ego act which is only part way along in the journey, and the person will take rebirth. But at another level, they have finished their work, and that's the way that is. It's just kind of a bizarre way to go out, but there's no really non-bizarre way to go out anyway. That's about all I have to say about suicide at this moment. Yeah. Suffering being so excellent, useful, why are we to alleviate it at every opportunity? Well, the situation is this, that for a person who is suffering, their suffering, the story I tell, I've told maybe, the story I tell of saying to somebody that says they want to fast for 9 days, great. And then they come up to you after 7 days and they say, "I haven't eaten for 7 days," and you say, "Wonderful." Okay? And then you walk out on the street and somebody comes up to you on the street and says, "Hey man, you got a quarter, I haven't eaten in 7 days." And you don't say, "Wonderful." See? Because that's a different kind of not eating than the other not eating is, if you will. And the situation is that I am have been involved in, at times, being responsible for someone else's sadhana, where I have imposed suffering collaboratively with them, where they have asked me to do that, and I said, you do this tapasya, or this austerity. For myself, when I am suffering, I work with it. I don't try to get rid of it, I just work with it. Right? For anybody who is suffering who is not connected with the consciousness that is able to transmute that energy or work with it, then it is just catching them more and more in attachment, and then you do the best you can to relieve it. Right? So that what you do about suffering depends on your level of consciousness. For most people, they are trying to optimize pleasure and minimize pain. And your job is, so when they're suffering, they're really suffering, is to help them out of it. Even though later, that same person, you may help them suffer, really. Okay? But you don't lay your trip on another person. And because you're one place in the wheel, you don't demand anybody else be at that place in the wheel. You honor each person's place, and you honor what has to be done about the suffering of each person around you. You don't just go around teaching like this, you know. There's no, unless you are totally free and are in a position to know who you have work to do with, even though they didn't ask you to do it. Yes. I got, how does despair and the emotions of pain function too, and I didn't get the rest of it. How does pain function to awaken? Despair, emotional pain, how do they function to awaken? I recall Maharaji with a young girl. He said to her, do you like suffering or do you like joy? Sorrow or joy? And she said, Maharaji, I've never known anything but sorrow. And he kept asking her, and he asked her four times, and she kept saying, Maharaji, I've never known anything but sorrow. He finally looked at her and he said, I just love sorrow. He says, it brings me so close to God. So in a way, the despair or the falling apart of your game, or the emptiness when your game isn't working anymore, or the seeing through the thing you'd invested in, all that is the collapse of the form, and in that collapse lies the possibility of the new perception. As long as you think you're making it, and you know what you're doing, and it's all together, and it's all perfect, you're probably sleepwalking. So that the confusion in the dance is to be, yeah, right. And the despair and the falling apart of all the forms you thought were meaningful a moment ago, great. Like people come to me and they say, I'm suffering. I say, great, suffer some more. You know, like at that point where they're doing, they're conscious of what their predicament is. I'm not trying to end despair, make it all nice. That isn't the game. It's very productive because it involves an emotion connected with the breaking up of models in your head, because the models aren't working the way you wanted them to. Just a couple of more and then we'll do a final kirtan together. Yeah. Question is, would I comment about the taking knowledge from Guru Maharaji, Balyogeshwar? As far as I understand it, I have not taken the knowledge, though I have been, it's been recommended to me in numerous letters. It involves being initiated into a form of nad yoga, sound yoga, light, nectar, and what's the other one? The word, yeah. The word. All of these are traditional yogic techniques. The initiation is done through the siddhi, that the power that Balyogeshwar has to transmit. That experience gives you a certain, when you have it, and you have it validly, not badly or whatever, badly done, or but when you're ready for it and you experience it, that strengthens your faith in the possibility of these inner connections to other planes of consciousness, and it gets you, gives you strength to do your sadhana, which keeps purifying you, which brings you into those spaces. It's an initiation, an investment, if you will. For many people who are approaching it from a somewhat hysterical emotional space, it is merely another experience to be collected, and it's not going to be very useful to them. in general, with a scene like that, it's best to focus on the methods themselves and on the Atman within Balyogeshwar. If you get caught in the 16-year-old playboy or in the organization, you are just lost in the frippery. But if you can look right through into who that being is behind all of the stuff, and you can work with the methods, then that's it's possible. It's a yoga. It's possible yoga. It's very, at one point, I think I said that the Indian government at one point was very critical of Maharishi Mahesh, and there was some question of whether or not I should help them confront him. And upon reflection with my teacher, Haridas, Haridas wrote in a slate, "Now leave him alone, because that is important work. That's the base work that must be done." And you get a feeling with these mass movements that they are taking people who are ready for certain things through those things, and maybe that won't be the whole trip for anyone, and maybe nobody's going to make it through fully on that one method. But it's doing a lot for a lot of people, and then they go on when they're done, and you just should respect. And when people come on to you and say, "Look, if you're not part of this scene, you're nowhere and you're blowing it," just love them. Because you realize people only proselytize out of their own lack of faith. When their faith is strong enough, they don't come on to anybody else. They just be it. Yes. The question was, is marriage, till death do us part, a fulfillment or a distortion of the path to enlightenment? It was just a week ago, was it? Last, was the day, the morning after the Shiva chant, that we had a wedding up on the hill in the meadow, and it was the first wedding ceremony that I had ever been invited, but I ever had the courage to, that I performed. And I reflected a great deal about all this. I said in the social lecture that I gave last week that most religions have a consecrated contract called marriage, which has in it the "till death do us part" quality. And what we in our society have done is converted the interpretation and meaning of that. And I've got to go back step a moment before that to give you the context. I was talking at the time about the different kinds of karma that we have to work with. And one, I said, was given karma for your birth, like if you're tall or short or dark or light or rich or poor, that's sort of given karma. That's the way it is. You can't trade your parents in. That's given for this round. You only get one set, you know. You can get other kinds of parents, but that's it. And originally, marriage was conceived of the same way parents. Once you took it on, it was karma for this lifetime. And if the marriage wasn't making it, that was the work. Just like if you don't get along with your parents, you say, "Well, they're my karma and I'm theirs." And we work with each other as best we can until I can be so clear with them that I can stay perfectly centered no matter what their trip is, and I can keep loving them, and that in turn will let them be free to give up their trip. And, or not give it up, because you are free to leave them alone to give it up or not give it up.